covered quite a lot of ground yesterday, so today I'm going to try and stay fairly focused. I want to talk about gravitational perturbation theory, and I'm going to kind of start off by motivating it with something, you know, that's sort of I've been quite involved in, which is a rather formal or theoretical problem in higher dimensional gravity. Nonetheless, gravitational perturbation theory is, you know, extremely useful tool because general relativity is, as you know, it's a nonlinear theory, and therefore it's very hard to find exact solutions. So in terms of actually using gravity, if we want to sort of try and test gravity, at least until very, very recently, we had to resort to compromises like thinking about high degrees of symmetry, like the black hole in cosmology, or gravitational perturbation theory, which was looking at things that were close to something that was nice and symmetric. Of course, in the last couple of years, we've now been able to test gravity in a far more dramatic and much more enjoyable way via black hole mergers. But of course, that requires some very intensive numerical computation. So that's sort of not so much something that we can do on a blackboard with pen and paper. Nonetheless, a lot of the tools and techniques, although the actual merger itself is done deep within the realms of, you know, of nonlinear gravity on a numerical relativity on a computer, a lot of the sort of tests or ways in which things are checked numerically is via sort of asymptotics when black holes are further apart, when we can use perturbation theory, or in the final stages when they're kind of ringing down, settling into their asymptotic state. So although we won't be doing that, it's quite heavy machinery, and that's coming from me, who usually isn't afraid to do stuff on a blackboard. Nonetheless, the basics, the basic ideas that we'll be confronting today are things that you would take forward into more complex situations. So as I said, I wanted to motivate this by something that was sort of close to my heart, if you like. So I want to recall one of the last things I wrote down yesterday. Which was a metric that I called a black string. So this is a solution to the vacuum Einstein equations, and it's basically a four-dimensional Schwarzschild metric. Cross an extra dimension. So it's either going to be cross R or an S1 if we're thinking of it in a Kaluza-Klein sense. So, either. So, this solution event horizon looks like a cylinder. So in four-dimensional vacuum gravity, event horizons have to be topologically spherical. So this was the first indication that when you went to higher dimensions, you start getting more possibilities. So event horizons don't necessarily have to be spherical. Here we've got one that's cylindrical. So if we imagine thinking about this a strip of length L of this event horizon, we could think of that as being the length of the extra dimension from a Kaluza-Klein perspective, then what we saw from a Kaluza-Klein perspective was that our G4, or G, was given in terms of the higher dimensional gravitational constant. So we have our radius, if I call my radius R4, then that's given in terms, my G here was just what I wrote down from our Schwarzschild solution, but it's implicitly a G4. So the mass of my cylinder is given by, it's actually given by this M parameter here. So it looks like you should have something that has the length of the cylinder in the mass, and indeed you do, but it's kind of a moot point as to whether you absorb it in your Newton's constant or have it explicitly out there. So then let me just write down what my entropy is. So remember, the entropy was roughly a quarter of the area. With a factor of G. So the area of the cylinder is the area of this event horizon, which is 4 pi r4 squared, times its length. So we see that the entropy of the cylinder goes like the mass squared. So now let's look at a 5D black hole. So the five-dimensional black hole, and I'm going to kind of, I think last time I wrote down the general form of the curvature for one of these higher dimensional objects, so I'm going to leave it kind of as an exercise to you, not only to verify this form, but to show by looking at the 0-0 Einstein equation. So just like we did for the Schwarzschild solution, we integrated up the 0-0 Einstein equation to get a relation for this 1 over b squared term, the radial part of the metric. So there's an exactly similar expression in higher dimensions, but of course it's dimension dependent. So I'll leave that as an exercise. So the mass of this five-dimensional black hole I get from, so this would be GD, I get simply from reversing this equation. Sorry, this, since I've written it for general dimensions, let me correct it for general dimensions. So we put in D as 5, because we're in 5 dimensions. We've got R5 squared times D minus 2, so that's the 3, times the area of a 3-sphere, which is 2 pi squared, and then we divide by 16 pi g5. So that's the mass of our black hole. So our mass is now equal to the square of the horizon radius. So when we look at our entropy, which is 1 over 4g5 times the area, well, the area is now the area of a three sphere. So we get our 2 pi squared, r5 cubed, and then we want to rewrite it in terms of the mass. And so we get this relation. So the entropies of the cylinder, the black string, and of the black hole have a somewhat different dependence on the mass or energy that they contain. So this means that if we think about it, so let's just put it, if I multiply each of these by g5, so I can compare them. The entropy of the black string is going like m squared on L, whereas the entropy of the black hole is going like m to the 3/2. So for a given mass, the entropy of the black string is going to be bigger if L is smaller and smaller if L is bigger. So given a thermodynamic intuition, you have this notion that entropy always wants to be maximized, big as possible. So if we have choices for a solution, how we distribute our mass, then we have to, or thermodynamically, we would imagine that our system would want to go for the state with the largest energy. So what this is saying is that if we believe the thermodynamics, skinny black string should be unstable because they have lower entropy than the black hole. So a skinny black string is one whose radius is small compared to its length. In other words, Gn is less than L. So if we just look at trying to put a number on that, so if I divide the entropy of the black hole by the entropy of the string, so the entropy of my string is just 4 pi g4 m squared, and then I've kind of rearranged a little bit the entropy of the black hole, I've sort of taken out my pie, root pie, and left, cancelled some of the pies off. This 3 to the 3/2 is the root, the 1/√27. And then I've rewritten G5 as G4L. And so I get this ratio, which is telling me at what point the entropy of the black hole gets bigger. So this means the instability should switch on So that gives me a precise notion of when, from an entropic perspective, I expect this instability. So this is, you know, I mean, that's a relatively straightforward argument, but it's using notions of black hole thermodynamics. Now, while those are sort of, you know, as reasonably justified as we can, we've got no evidence that black holes radiate. The only reason that we really want to assign them an entropy is so that we don't have thermodynamics in our universe being violated by simply throwing all our junk into a black hole. So although we have good physical reasons for believing in black hole thermodynamics, we've got no direct evidence. So, I think when I was talking about thermodynamics or these sort of various quantum gravity style arguments, I was always being a little bit cautious and saying that at least from a fundamental or rigorous perspective, we couldn't necessarily justify these arguments. But here we've got something where we've got this very intuitive type of reason to expect that black strings are unstable, but it's not coming from anything that's actually been tested. However, the statement, a classical solution in vacuum Einstein gravity is unstable, is a statement that we can check within the realms of classical vacuum Einstein gravity with no reference at all to any sort of concepts of quantum gravity, Euclidean or otherwise, or even quantum field theory. So this is a statement or prediction, an expectation that we can check. Right, so how do we check whether something is stable or unstable? We perturb it, we prod it. We just give it a little nudge away from its equilibrium. If something is stable, then we expect it'll just kind of oscillate, wobble a little bit. Usually then energy is dissipated and it settles back down. That's a characteristic of a stable system. if something is unstable, we prod it and we expect that it starts to sort of oscillate more and more wildly until it goes off into some completely new and different configuration. So we check this. By a perturbation theory, and this is something that is no doubt very familiar. So this is, we're going to sort of think about it and motivated it from this black string perspective. But for example, if you want to use or test gravity, then it's also useful for solar system tests. So, for example, perihelion precession of Mercury, which you probably saw with Neil, that's done via taking our solar system as basically the Newtonian system plus an extra little piece, which is coming from GR. We don't ever solve the full solar system in all its non-linear glory, because that would be an utter waste of time, because general relativistic corrections are absolutely tiny. So when a GR correction is tiny, it's a good idea to use perturbation theory. So perturbation theory, we can use it in solar system tests. It's also absolutely indispensable in cosmology, because in cosmology, we have a setup where we want to describe the ultimate system, which is our own universe, which we do within the context of general relativity. But in order to do it, we make this compromise of saying our universe is incredibly symmetric. Now, our universe is pretty symmetric on very large scales, but obviously not locally. And so again, we have this notion that our universe is very smooth up to this tiny, tiny amount, and we actually know what that is experimentally. It's of 1 in 10 to the minus 5. And so 10 to the minus 5 is a nice, wonderful small number. So we use perturbation theory. And also perturbation theory can be used when you want to calculate, gravity of sources, that's your solar system test, but also gravitational radiation. If you want to just get a leading order approximation to a system, say, which is radiating gravitationally. So if you had a binary system, for example, where it's not anywhere near a sort of case of two either black holes or neutron stars being about to merge, but a binary system is continually radiating gravitationally, but the amount of energy it's radiating is absolutely minuscule compared to the total energy. And so then again, that's something else that you can do in perturbation theory just to get an idea of what's going on. So that's the sort of general idea. You get a background, plus, which we know, and we add a little wrinkle. So in other words, we take a background metric and add a perturbation. Now, just to be annoying, notation because we used HAB for the first fundamental form. HAB was actually first used for perturbations. So people didn't really do much Gauss-Kadatsi till, really the last 25 or 30 years. So whereas perturbation theory and GR has a much longer history. So unfortunately, H is used conventionally in both descriptions. So I apologize for the duplication of notation, but it is conventional. So here, note two things. H is now our delta G, not our first fundamental form. And not delta G inverse. So remember, like when we did our variational principle. So H really is delta of metric not delta of inverse metric, not the first fundamental form. So,
Can you explain again what the 10 to the minus 5 is correcting?
Oh, for cosmology?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So in cosmology, what we want to do is we want to actually form structure, galaxies, at least in the first instance. And so the way we do that is actually via, we have essentially the general relativistic equivalent of the gravitational genes instability, which is that essentially gravity always wins at large scales. So we have to generate structure from perturbations. Now, we know the perturbations aren't too big, otherwise our universe wouldn't look as nice and smooth as it does. And so the reason we know it's 10 to the minus 5 is the evidence from the cosmic microwave background. So you'd be doing, if you do the cosmology course, you'll do it in cosmology. But experimentally, we know that that is the scale of the perturbations. And so cosmologically, we have sort of two things. First of all, we have to check that we've got this snapshot of the universe at a particular time. We have to evolve it forward, allowing gravitational perturbation theory to generate our structure. And then the other challenge is, from a high energy perspective, we've got to generate those perturbations in the first place. So, and well, I guess what I'm about to do is probably more, certainly much more crucial for the latter, which is that sort of description, than the former, where in fact astronomers, I call them astronomers, they like themselves theorists, do Newtonian gravity essentially in their simulations. Okay, so this is our starting point. We're going to split our metric into a background piece and a perturbation. In the back of our mind, we will assume, and you should know by now this is a delicate thing, that H is in some sense small, which we can actually, with hindsight, figure out what we mean by that. But for the moment, from the perspective of mechanically deriving a perturbation equation, what we're going to do is we're going to ignore terms of order h squared. So we go through, we calculate our Ricci tensor for g naught plus h, but we throw away everything that's not linear in H. That way we're going to get a set of linear equations for H. Okay, so our first step is to find delta gamma. Which, if we just wrote it down, we'd get this form, but we've done this, so I don't need to do this in a great deal of detail. We kind of use our normal coordinate trick to find that this is given in terms of a sequence of covariant derivatives of H. So that is our connection. And then the variation of our Ricci tensor, which, if you remember, we found by the Palatini lemma. It was given in terms of covariant derivatives of the variation of a connection. And we can just write this down straight off. As a combination of four double derivatives of our perturbation. So now, notice we've got this divergence here, but there's a covariant derivative in between. And so what I'd like to do is to commute these derivatives, because what I want is to have a gradient term right next to the H. So we're going to use the Riemann identity. To basically swap these derivatives here. So grad C, grad A of HCB is grad A, grad C, HCB. And then I've got to add two Riemann terms. And so I apply, I've already used the Riemann identity on the first term, but then I do the same thing on the second term, which you notice is the same as the first, but with A and B swapped. So I've just swapped the order of the covariant differentiation there, but now I want to group things together. So I define a sort of, well, in four dimensions, it's a trace reversed H, but basically it's a sort of combination of H and its trace. Essentially, so these three terms now become a divergence of this H bar. So just pulling that together, using that H-bar, what I end up with is what we call a Lichnerowicz operator, which is the curved space wave operator for the gravitational field, for the spin 2 field. So you see that even if you're in vacuum, in other words, Ricci is zero, you've still got a Riemann piece there, and you've also got this... Oh, sorry, this should be an H-bar. You've also got this divergent term here of this H-bar tensor. So that is our curved space wave operator. But now I'm going to come back to thinking about issues with doing perturbation theory. So we've derived this by ignoring terms of order H squared, So we need to think what it means by h being small. And so in order to do that, we've probably got to know about the background. So that will, again, set that one aside just for the time being. So what else can go wrong? Well, we know that gravity has a very large gauge group. We have our coordinate transformations. So we can write the same space in a lot of different ways with different labels. Now, often, so all of the examples that we've seen so far, the gauge choice, our choice of coordinates, has been something that's been very obvious. We've not, you know, if we write flat space in Cartesian coordinates or polar coordinates, it's not changing our fundamental understanding of the underlying geometry because they're very familiar. We're used to polar coordinates. We've worked with them for a long time. But if we find a new exact solution, coordinates, we're not really actually sure what it is. We have to investigate. We can't make assumptions about when the metric is singular, you know, like we do when we write down polar coordinates. We never even think to focus in on the coordinate singularity at theta equals zero or pi. In fact, we more often than not just pretend it doesn't exist because, well, it's not a problem. We know how to deal with it. But if we have a brand new metric, you know, with coordinates squiggle, dosh, splosh, and splash, then we have no idea what those coordinates mean. And if we see the determinant of the metric going to zero, for example, or a metric coefficient going to zero, we've really got no idea whether that's a real singularity or just a gauge choice, at least not without rolling our sleeves up and starting to look in detail, like we did with that domain wall, where we saw something going to zero, we actually stepped back, we thought about what it was doing, and then we derived a coordinate transformation. So here we are, we've taken a space-time, we've shaken it a bit, we've pulled out an HAB. How do we know that that corresponds to a physical deformation? So the way we find that out is we say, well, let's make a coordinate transformation and ask what it does. So our gauge transformation is where we set, at least locally, we change our coordinates. So we shift our coordinates locally by a small amount, which I'm going to call xi. So that is my gauge transformation. Under this coordinate transformation, we have our metric changing. By an amount proportional to the Lie derivative. So let me move to rewrite this on another board. So if we change coordinates, our metric changes by a little amount. In other words, we actually generate a perturbation. So this is a bit of a problem because this means that if we find a solution to this Lichnerowicz operator, it could just be a coordinate transformation. So we need to try and be precise about what is a coordinate transformation and what is physical. So let's look and see if we can make a gauge choice. So that was actually the reason for introducing this h-bar. So my h-bar is just my h minus the trace of h, which is the divergence of xi, times gab. So if I look at its divergence, then I get the following relation. I've got the wave operator acting on psi plus a commutator of derivatives. So I have this, again, this is a curved space wave operator for a vector. So that, because that is just a curved space wave operator, it's a completely sort of normal type of D'Alembertian. And so if I set it equal to a source, then I can solve for my xi. So what this means is that if my divergence of my h-bar is not zero in the first place, I simply put it on the right-hand side here, calculate my xi, and do that coordinate transformation to get rid of it. In other words, I can choose a gauge, choose coordinates to make this divergence zero. So this is the Dodonda gauge, and it's the most commonly used gauge in relativistic perturbation theory. So we're going to do that. Let's move forward. We've got rid of the piece, the ugliest piece in the Lichnerowicz operator. And we can't get rid of Riemann or Ricci because they're physical. And the box HAB is what we expect from a wave operator. So we've now reduced our Lichnerowicz down to terms that we have a sort of implicit physical understanding of. Wave equation with appropriate curved space corrections. So what's left? So let's do a gauge transformation where x goes to x plus chi. And let's ask if there's any sort of non-trivial solutions for chi. So we must have preserve our Dodonda gauge. So under a coordinate transformation, I mean, that should be xi there, the gradient of h bar is this curved space wave operator for the vector. So this tells me that grad chi plus r chi has to be zero to preserve Dodonda. Again, this is just saying that chi is sort of the equivalent of a massless vector in curved space. And so we have D solutions, D linearly independent solutions to that wave equation in D dimensions. So let's count our degrees of freedom. So HAB is symmetric tensor. So it has D into D plus 1 over 2 components, independent components. So if we just wrote down a symmetric tensor, we might think we had D into D plus 1 and 2 degrees of freedom. We've got a gauge constraint. So there are D equations here. So that's D constraints. And that gets us to H in the Dodonda gauge. On top of that, we see that we can still do D coordinate transformations that preserve our gauge choice. So that we have D remaining gauge degrees of freedom. So what that means is the number of our physical solutions in D dimensions is D into D minus 3 over 2. So in four dimensions, I've got 4 times 1 over 2, and I get 2. And so these are our sort of propagating degrees of freedom of the gravitational wave. So we conventionally write those as polarization states of a cross and a plus. In D equals 5, I've got 5 times 5 minus 3, which is 2 over 2. So I've got 5 degrees of freedom. And so you can think of these as being cross and plus polarization states in the two orthogonal, in 5 dimensions, you've got 4 space dimensions, which you can split into 2 cross 2, so each of those 2 dimensions has a plus and a cross mode, and then you've got a sort of cross mode between the two-dimensional subspaces. So that tells us about the number of physical degrees of freedom in our gravitational wave in an arbitrary number of dimensions. So you can see that they get very complicated very quickly. Because at large D, it goes like D squared. So I'll just try and sketch out how we use this perturbation theory for the black string, and then if I've got time, I'll sketch out how we use it for the warp compactification in the Randall-Sundrum model. So this is just taking the idea of having a small perturbation and asking what equation of motion does it satisfy, and we see that it satisfies a wave equation, so we're essentially talking about, at least if these are propagating, time-dependent propagating degrees of freedom, we're talking about a wave. So what about an instability? So the black string has quite a few killing vectors. It's got an SO3 algebra. It's got d by dt and d by dz. So typically what we do when we have a background that has a lot of symmetries is we decompose our perturbation with respect to those symmetry groups. So for d by dt, that might give us e to the I omega t. So that's like our standard frequency, or e to the omega t for an instability. So because our metric doesn't depend on time, it means our perturbations are going to just have, we can sort of treat different frequency perturbations independently in linearized theory. Because of a d by dz, we can write e to the I mu z. So this is like a wavelength, sort of having some rippling in the z direction. Then, for our SO3, it means that we can decompose our metric into, our perturbation into modes with specific angular momenta. So these will be based on the standard angular momentum modes that you've sort of seen already for scalars. But because we've got tensors, the expression is more complicated. So that was done in the 1950s by Reggie and Wheeler. And it's a reasonably accessible paper. So if you're looking at black perturbations of normal 4D black holes, that's what you'd have to do. For the 5D string, the entropy argument didn't sort of take into account any distortion of the spherical part of the horizon. So we do not expect the instability to have any angular momentum, any angular distortion at all. So this is what we expect for the black string instability from the entropy argument. The entropy argument is just comparing a cylinder with a sphere, which means that things are changing in the z direction. So we do expect a z dependence, And so we then say, okay, so let's decompose our perturbations with respect to this extra dimension. So this is actually quite analogous to what you do in cosmology. Because we've got this Z killing vector, in this case, we've got this extra direction, we can think about decomposing our perturbation into scalar, vector, and tensor modes with respect to the four-dimensional Schwarzschild metric. So we take an e to the I mu z, and then we decompose our perturbations with respect to the four-dimensional black hole type subspace. So we can show quite straightforwardly I guess what I mean is for if I take the imaginary part of omega, if I look for an instability in HZZ and HZ mu, I don't get one. I can show that that is that gives an inconsistent equation. So what I'm left with is just a component of H in the four-dimensional directions, which I can write in this form. So let me just get that board up so you can see it. So what I'm left with is just a perturbation in the four-dimensional black hole part of the metric. It depends on Z. It has this omega t rather than I omega t. So that tells you it's an instability. And then it has zero angular momentum, which means the only thing that can happen is that the theta phi directions can grow or shrink, but they can't distort. So because h mu nu depends on z, if we get a solution, it's actually physical. We cannot gauge it away because we've got a Z dependence in it. So any solutions to this Lichnerowicz equation are actually physical. And so what you can do and what Raymond Laflamme and I did was to look at that form of the metric, to use our gauge constraints, to input it into the Lichnerowicz operator, and it boils down to second order differential equation in a single variable. Let's call it HTR for the sake of argument. And so then it becomes an eigenvalue problem. So we've got like HTR double primed plus a function of R HTR primed, function of R HTR primed and HTR equals mu squared HTR. and it becomes an eigenvalue problem, and you can find solutions for omega as a function of mu. So what that means is that for sufficiently small mu, you get an instability. So small mu is long wavelength. And this is a bit analogous to like that gene's instability, but for long wavelength modes on your black string, you do indeed get a classical instability. So what happens is your event horizon, which was a cylinder, becomes something that ripples. And then Louis Lehner here at Perimeter and Franz Pretorius actually followed the instability through numerically, and it sort of had showed that this black string kind of split off. And in fact, you got this sort of nice self-similar fractal type of behavior where you kept seeing instabilities of smaller and thinner strings. So that's totally classical general relativity, and yet it's confirmed this very intuitive heuristic argument that came from thinking about entropy. So it seems as if, even though interpretations of entropy and black hole radiation, etc., require sort of ideas from quantum field theory or sort of pseudo-quantum gravity, they are at least backed up by our general theory of general relativity. And so it's kind of a really nice verification of all of this other sort of these ideas that we've been developing over the past couple of weeks, with where, you know, if one was being extremely picky and rigorous, mathematically rigorous, you would sort of feel a little bit uneasy. But I think, you know, what this is showing is that this really is something real, that we really should be taking thermodynamics of black holes seriously. So I'll stop there.